Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hello and welcome to the Damcasters. This is just a quick introduction before we cut to what is the audio of a video we recorded while we were at the Pima Air and Space Museum. And within the Pima Air and Space Museum is the 390th Bomb Group Memorial Museum, which houses a fabulous B-17G with a very interesting history and also the collection of the 390th Bomb Group. It is a very very interesting museum and incredibly well done. In today's episode, we are given a tour of the B-17G, which is painted up as I'll Be Round, by Alex Chambers, who's the business and operations manager who has basically taken it on himself to figure out everything he can about the fortress, and also Keith Cook, who's the director of archives and collections, who's going to show us around the fantastic collection of A2 painted flying jackets that they have. So, without further ado, here is the audio from that. If you want to watch it, it's on our YouTube channel. Do check that out. Of course, if you wanted this nice and early and as an uncut-ish video, join us on Patreon, which is just £3 a month plus a bit of VAT. You get all of this early, different intro and an outro, which there won't be to this episode. You get all that early ad-free, but we realize times are tough. So if you can help us out by liking, subscribing, putting some stars into your podcast app of choice, if you want to leave a review, that would be fantastic. Stars and even an emoji as a review all helps the algorithm. And just telling your friends, sharing it, that is all fantastic. And it all helps our algorithmic overlords to help push the podcast far and wide. So thank you for all your support. That's that bit done. Without further ado, we're going to go off to Tucson, the fabulous Pima Air and Space Museum, and the incredible 390th Memorial Museum. Welcome to the Damcasters, brought to you in association with the Pima Air and Space Museum. I'm your host, Matt Bone.
Hello, we are back at a special place in the Pima Air and Space Museum, which is the 390th Bomb Group Memorial Museum. And we're here with Alex, who's going to be showing us around. And let's just get you to do that full introduction again, because you did it so well. Who are you, sir?
My name is Alex Chambers. I'm the business and operations manager here at the 390th Memorial Museum.
Wonderful. So, Alex, you've, considering your office is covered in pictures of this fantastic aircraft before she was restored to the state she's in now, you're going to show us around, tell us about her past life and what you've found during the restoration.
Yeah, this is a really interesting airframe in and of itself. So it's restored back to its World War II configuration, back to as it rolled off the Vega assembly line at Burbank. It's in the markings of the 390th, so it carries the tail number of 4231892. That was a B-17 that flew 24 combat missions from England over Germany, France, and Belgium, and it was shot down after 4 months of combat missions. Mm. So this plane that it represents did not survive the war. It's named All Be Around, but as it was discovered, after it had been restored to this configuration, it was actually painted olive drab the whole time it was in England fighting the air war over Germany. So In its bare metal configuration, it's not accurate to the tail number it carries right now. Also, the nose art is not accurate to that plane. Mm-hmm. After the guys over at Davis Mothan had restored it back to this paint scheme, they saw an HBO special called Reunion at Farborough, and there was a shot of that airplane, that real airplane, and it was olive drab, and it had this totally different nose art. So it's a bit of a fictional representation of a World War II plane right now.
But I suppose it's going to be good for showing the length and the different types of aircraft that the 390th flew during its time in England. So
exactly. Yeah.
So you'll be able to pick out quite a bit. So we've been teasing everybody by having it behind the camera. And everyone, the fabulous Joe Welding, is on camera duty. So become a damn Casteran patron. And you never know, you can join me here at the museum. So where do you want to start?
You know, I think the tail is a fantastic place to start because that's where we're representing the 390th.
Great.
So the square J on our tail represents the 390th bomb group. The 3rd Air Division was represented with squares, and the J designates it as the 390th bomb group here.
Oh, so that's why some have the triangles.
Exactly. Yeah. The three different air divisions were represented by different shapes, and the J represents the 390th specifically.
Okay.
It's a partial serial number, a tail number on the plane. So the real serial number that this represents is 42-31892.
Okay.
The Air Force still uses that same moniker in its serial numbers. Mm-hmm. The first two digits would be the year that Congress approved purchasing the airframe. So this represents a plane that was approved and financed in 1942.
So it's not a manufacturing year, it's when it went onto the books.
Exactly.
Okay. Okay, so this is your game, mate. Off you go. Show us around. We're just here geeking out. So what is it about this section that's you're going to show us first?
Well, you know, I think we should, let's talk first about the real serial number. The real serial number of this airplane is 4485828.
Okay.
That's the real airframe. Mm-hmm. It's one of the last 13 B-17s produced at the Vega Burbank plant. Mm-hmm. So that's the real serial number of this plane. And that's what would have been emblazoned on this tail when it was delivered to the Army Air Force in July of 1945.
So too late for Europe, but I guess they had the Pacific in the back of their mind.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So it was sent to the Dallas Love Modification Center, the Lockheed Mount at Dallas Love Field, mm-hmm. For some additional equipment to prepare it for a potential air war.
Okay.
But then it ended up going in storage at Lubbock, Texas.
Okay.
While it was in storage at Lubbock, Texas, the Navy set aside a large block of these final Vega-built B-17s. Those Vega B-17s were then diced up between the Navy and the Coast Guard. The Coast Guard was assigned 20 different serial numbers. 16 ended up being delivered to the Coast Guard starting in 1946.
Okay.
The Navy finished the modifications. So it was built as a B-17G, then was assigned to the Navy, then the Coast Guard got a hold of it and it was redesignated a PB-1G. And it was reconfigured to TB-17H U.S. Army Air Force configuration, which was an air-sea rescue configuration.
Okay.
So all the gun emplacements, the ball turret, the side guns, the top turret, the chin turret, all of those were removed, and a radar was installed in the nose.
Okay.
So at one time, it had the provisions to have a Higgins lifeboat strapped to the bottom, but we don't believe that RB-17 ever had that Higgins lifeboat attached to it. It was the only Coast Guard PB-1G that never had that Higgins lifeboat. Then, in 1947, this B-17 was sent for further modifications. Where our ball turret is, was gutted out, and a large 9-lens camera was installed right here.
Oh, wow.
This camera had been built by Fairchild in the 1930s. It was delivered to the Navy, well, potentially to the Navy in 1936. Mm-hmm. And it was used with the Navy's joint research efforts with the U.S. Coast and Geodetic Survey. The U.S. Coast and Geodetic Survey was the first scientific administration of the U.S. government. It was formed in 1807, and this large 9-camera lens had been in a PBY Catalina during the war and then was slapped in RB-17.
So what was the camera used for?
It was used for mapping the continental United States. So from 1947 through 1959, this one B-17 mapped Puerto Rico, the entire continental United States, including Alaska.
Oh, right.
And it started really a lot of the mapping that would become very important later. So it was doing coastal mapping. That was really the original mission. But that camera was able to pick up terrain and elevation features that were very important for aerial maps, mm-hmm. as well as road building projects that would be going on as the U.S. was rebuilding after World War II.
So slightly stereoscopic images they were collecting from it.
Exactly. Yeah. So it was a ring of 8 camera lenses with one center camera lens.
Oh, right.
And it would take...
So almost like the 360 Insta cameras you get now.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It would take a 2-foot by 2-foot square image, mm-hmm. and it took 200 feet of camera roll to do one mapping mission. So there was 9 Coast Guard guys flying the plane and 3 U.S. Coast and Geodetic Survey guys operating the equipment. 1 navigator and 2 camera operators.
Okay.
Which is incredible. And they used the Norden bomb site from World War II to target where they were going to map.
So that might explain why some of the maps were a bit iffy.
Maybe, a little bit. Yeah.
Well, that's really interesting, because I know at the end of the Second World War, a lot of Bomber Command flew what they called the Cook's Tours, mm-hmm. which was just photographing Europe. So they'd fly missions out, essentially doing the same thing with big cameras, to get more accurate maps for whatever might happen next.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
So it's similar that they were doing Europe, but then there was this opportunity to use these aircraft to fill in a lot of the gaps in the U.S. because there, you know, you had the maps, but there wasn't the detail for what was hoping. Because I remember that from school, because they did it in Canada as well.
Yeah, very important to this mid-century. A lot of construction projects, expansion of cities, the interstate highways, canal projects, dam building. Mm-hmm. This mapping was very important for a lot of the public works that went on. Mm-hmm.
Fantastic. Right. What's next?
So one of the pieces of evidence of its Coast Guard days is our door here. So in World War II, a B-17 would have had pins on the doors that would have just been pulled, and the door would have been released if a crew needed to jump out. Mm-hmm. Our B-17 door is hinged.
Okay. So it's coming. Of course it is going in. Yeah, that's obvious now that I say it.
Yeah. Yeah. So one piece of evidence that's left over probably from 1946-1947.
Ah.
And then we can pull back the ladder here. If we want to take a look inside, I want to show you the flooring around the ball turret.
Do you need a hand or are you good?
Now we should be good here. There we go. All right, so I'm not the most graceful in getting in this plane, unfortunately.
Point the camera at me while I was doing that.
So you can come on in here.
Okay. Now, don't point the camera at me for this. It's like we did this yesterday, climbing into a Boeing aircraft. Very gracefully. There you go. So what's that on our list so far? B-52A and B-17G in 2 days.
Yeah.
We're doing well.
So as you see it now, oops, it's been reconfigured to its World War II configuration, mm-hmm. with our waist guns and a ball turret. And our frame that holds up our ball turret is actually out of a B-24 that was cut and welded to be B-17 size. Our ball turret was found, as I've heard, under a little old lady's porch. So very unique. But you can see how there's wood planking around the ball turret.
Yep.
That's not accurate to the World War II configuration. And I have some photos of it as a Coast Guard plane with the camera. And the reason it has that wood planking all around the ball turret was so that the camera operators could sit there and maintain the camera and operate it.
Okay. So it's you've got a little bit of both of the lives that you're trying to tell still in the aircraft with that. And I guess I always do that when I get in these things, sort of smashing your head around. I was in a bow fighter once. It wasn't nice. I guess we have to remember, it's not the camera on your phone that you just point and click. It's going to be constant maintenance. It's going to be vibrating a lot as well. Mm-hmm. So it may malfunction, film jams, all those good things we remember from our youths.
Yeah, it was a 750-pound camera in here. And then you had somewhere in where we're standing, 200 feet of camera or a film rolled. So these guys were constantly having to maintain this thing. They flew about 5,000 hours on the plane.
Oh, right.
So when it was delivered to the Coast Guard, it had just 55 hours of flight time on the aircraft. When the Coast Guard finally parked it in October of 1959, it had 5,515 flight hours on the airplane.
So she had a life that most B-17s would never have seen.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Wow. And it's part of the reason it was maintained in such a high condition, because it was needed. It had a job to do.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. And
that was again struck by size. Yeah, I'm just about. I'm able to stand up because the tail fins there, so the top isn't together. But it's, you know, we're three gentlemen of stature. Being in this thing with electric suit, flying gear, and I guess the guys with taking the footage would still be in all the same gear as well, because on a cold day, it's going to be bloody freezing in here.
Exactly. Yeah. They were up at 30,000 feet for a mapping mission. Typical combat missions were 26 to somewhere around 30,000 feet. So they literally used their World War II gear. They had the electric bunny suits. They were wearing heavy leathers, oxygen masks. All the equipment that was necessary for the combat missions was retained by the Coast Guard.
You see, that is the obvious question I should have asked, because I did not think they'd be that high.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're getting, on that two-foot picture, you're getting a phenomenal amount of detail on that from that sort of height.
Exactly.
Well, you are in that sort of photographic reconnaissance sort of range, aren't you? From high altitude to long focal length lenses.
Yeah, I think that two-foot-by-two-foot piece of film was about 120 square miles on each shot.
So I guess that's what, a picture every 120 miles at what, cruise speed of 200?
Yeah, that's math.
Yeah, that's math. I'll do it. We'll figure it out. We'll put a little text bit up on the bottom of the video saying we did the math later.
Yeah.
Wow, okay. So that's good. And so we can tell she's a G as well because of the offset waist gun position.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And we're missing a few things. There would have been armor plating here in front of each gunner. That's something that we haven't replicated yet. And I doubt they would have had that in the Coast Guard days, trying to save weight. Certainly, a lot of this was also stripped out from its firefighting days.
Yeah.
So it flies with the Coast Guard until October 14th, 1959. Mm-hmm. Its last mission is in Alaska. It lands at Boeing Field in Seattle in a ceremony to commemorate it being the last flying B-17. It's parked in Elizabeth City, New Jersey in October 1959. It's put up for sale shortly afterwards, 1960. It's purchased by a civil operator and becomes N9323R. And it's gutted of pretty much everything. We don't really know what happened to it for those first 2 years that it was in private ownership. But then it was quickly acquired by Dothan Aviation in Dothan, Alabama. Mm-hmm. And I don't know where the hoppers would have been, probably in the bomb bay. But it was first set up as an agricultural sprayer.
Oh, right. Okay.
So in our bomb bay would have been a big hopper, and it had spray bars on the back of the wings. And it was used for fighting fire ants.
Fire ants?
Mm-hmm.
Flipping heck. This is a mad career for this aircraft.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Just to say, was she the last B-17 flying for the U.S. government?
Any branch of the U.S. government flown by a manned crew. Okay. There were a number of drones used in atomic bomb tests shortly after this plane, but they were not manned. They'd already been set up as drones.
Okay.
So they just flew into nuclear wasteland.
We've done an episode about that as well. So she is really a special aircraft.
Yes.
Yeah. So, yeah. Didn't get to fight the Germans, but got to fight fire ants and fires.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Cool. Right. Continue, sir. Which way do you want us to go?
You know, let's head up. Out and up to the nose of the plane, real quick.
I'll jump out first. Hopefully more gracefully than I got in. We can film Joe getting out, which will be quite funny. Oh, he did it so well. There we go. It's when you see them sort of getting into the nose, when they just sort of reach up and lift their to the legs in as well, and you think, how the hell? If I tried doing that, I'd put my back out.
Right. Thank you, sir.
That's right.
Perfect.
Cool. Right, that way.
Yeah, I haven't found any evidence of the spray bars still on it. And I have seen pictures, not of our airplane, but of other B-17s that use the hard points here. So here's where our hard points start. You've got four bolt holes here.
Okay.
And up here, you have four more bolt holes.
So you get a great shot of it from like right here.
So these four here, and then these four here.
Mm-hmm. And that's where a hard point would have been attached for carrying 1,000-pound bombs during the war. That was rarely used on the B-17Gs, but it was a provision they had to carry extra load. A B-17G could carry up to 8,000 pounds, 6,000 pounds internally, and 2,000 pounds under the wing. This was retained, we don't know why, by the Coast Guard, and as the ag sprayer with Dothan, I don't know if they would have had tanks here or if those would have been in the bomb bay. But there are some B-17s that you see that were converted to sprayers that used these hardpoints for large tanks. Looks like P-51 or P-38 drop tanks converted for spraying. And the really unique thing is right here. Let's see if we can get it open. That is the bomb release mechanism. Sentimental Journey and Sally B both do not have that wiring. Most of the B-17s after the war had all that wiring gutted out of it.
And then that just patched up and sealed, yeah.
Yeah, how ours retained that and survived all those years of different operators is a mystery.
Wow.
And a really rare piece of B-17 history.
That's amazing. When I saw the little model with the 1,000-pounders underneath it that you have over there, I was like, oh, that's a little bit of this aircraft, the B-17 as a whole, that always has slipped my mind. Because we sort of get into, especially being in England, it's, oh, isn't it nice? It's got a small bomb load. It's not a Lancaster. You know, a mosquito could carry this amount.
Yeah.
But when you see the extra provisions going in and seeing something like that, that is, you know, they weren't standing still, were they?
No, yeah. No. And this was really a late war provision on the B-17s. Mm-hmm. You talk to Colonel Bichong, he never flew with the hard points. He flew F and G models, and none of his planes had this provision for it. This was really just the end production runs of G models that had it. Mm-hmm.
I don't think he would have cared.
Yeah.
Right. Onwards. Where next?
Yeah. So just jumping back really quickly to its Coast Guard days, the chin turret was the first thing that they removed. So it was built with a chin turret. All G models had that extra defensive mechanism. They replaced this with a radar here for all the Coast Guard PB-1Gs. It retained that for its photo mapping missions. It was, I believe, a ground scanning radar and weather radar that they had there. So this is an entire reproduction. It's not an original chin turret. So our chin turret's not original. Our tail's not original. Our ball turret is a real ball turret, thankfully.
Yeah. But it's done well enough that you wouldn't really notice. And I always love the zippers on the turret. Mm-hmm. You just sort of think, when that order went out.
Yeah. That high-speed aerodynamic device.
Yes.
Pick up just a couple of knots.
Yes. So I think it's one of the things about aviation that's always fascinating is the adaptability of aircraft you wouldn't think would be that adaptable. So, yeah, there's someone sitting around saying, well, we can get a radar in there, we put a camera in the back, and just keep them going for a long while because they've got the range, they're durable. Yeah, you know, reliable as all get up by this point, and you can crack on from there to make its mission life do something entirely different to what it was originally purposed for. I love that.
Yeah, and they had all the parts. There were tons of 1820 engines sitting around in Kingman. There were tons of these airframes sitting around in Lubbock and Kingman and NAS Litchfield. So it was cheap. It was easy to service. There were lots of men that were trained on it. There were lots of men that knew how to repair it. And it had very functioning pieces of equipment like the Norden bombsight.
Yep.
And then they just updated more modern radios, more modern radar, really advancements of the late 40s and 50s that had come out of the war.
Mm-hmm. And you've got the bear in the nose?
That's Colonel Bichong's bear. He brought that in personally.
Did he?
Insisted we put it up there to commemorate Roscoe Ann.
Tune in for our interview from last year with Dick, which was just fantastic. I'm just gutted we didn't get over to see him yesterday, but I'll just have to sneak back soon.
He's here every Thursday.
Yeah, he is wonderful. Hello, Roscoe. All right, onwards, sir. Keep us going.
Let's look up our front hatch here.
I beg your pardon.
So as you climb up this, you'll be able to see a serial number tag on here. That's where the original serial number would have been. And R still retains its U.S. Coast Guard bureau number 77254.
So she's still got a bit of her identity.
Exactly. That Army Air Force number is gone, the manufacturer serial number is gone, but its Coast Guard number was retained.
But we were just saying before, that 5,000-hour figure is just remarkable for an airframe like this. And I guess not having to go through what many of its sisters had to, but it's in really good condition for an aircraft that was flown 5,000 hours with the mapping service and then all the years as a fire bomber. And
exactly. Yeah. Yeah, and it flew in Alaska, it flew in Puerto Rico on these mapping missions. The Coast Guard obviously maintained it. Mm. But you can see some evidence of its life, like see some of the dings in our skin here. That's probably ice coming off of the propeller here. Mm-hmm. Now, what's interesting is it would have had to have had its de-icing system with the Coast Guard. But when we inspected this plane, it's all been removed, probably from its firefighting days. Mm. Because as a firefighter, it was down fighting in the summer months mostly, yeah. Up in Montana, up in Wyoming, in California. It didn't need its de-icing.
Okay.
So there's a de-icing system that sprays glycol on the propellers, and that has all been removed from this aircraft
when
we got it. During the war, they also had de-icing boots on the wings, but those were commonly, well, and the wings and the tails, those were commonly removed because they were found to be ineffective during the war.
Yes, they'd push the button and usually nothing would happen because the boots had frozen.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, so then this thing is retired from the Coast Guard. In 1960, it sells for about $6,000 at an auction at Elizabeth City, New Jersey. The guy that purchased it, he turns around and he sells it 2 months later for $13,500. It sits around for a year or two. It ends up in Dothan. It has the hopper and the sputter bars added to it, fights fire ants. It's only at Dothan for, I think, 3 or 4 months, something like that. He has 4 B-17s total, and he ends up selling this B-17 to Black Hills Aviation, and they convert it to a firefighting plane. So they strip out the bomb bay, and they build a tank where the bomb bay is.
Okay.
And it's a slurry bomber, and it fights fires, essentially until 1975 with Black Hills. So it fights with Black Hills as B-30 is its firefighting tail number. It later has tanker number 37 applied to it, and I believe it fought fires into the maybe 76, 77 fire season.
Oh, right.
And it's parked in 1978 up just north of here in Mesa, Arizona at Falcon Field, where the Commemorative Air Force now has Sentimental Journey.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of firefighters that are parked up there. Air Specialties then negotiates with the Air Force Museum in Dayton at that time, now known as the National Museum of the Air Force. And he trades this B-17 back to the Air Force, back to its original owner, for a C-54 out of the boneyard. So a military version of a DC-4. The story is, and I don't know how accurate this is, he puts his 4 highest hour engines on the plane. He flies it down from Mesa into Davis-Monthan here right across the street. He picks up his C-54 and he takes off. So we know it's traded back in about 78 on paper. Mm-hmm. In 1980, there's a big ceremony. So in November of 1980, it flies in and it's escorted by a P-51. So at the time, it's in this bare metal, it's got orange cowling, it's got an orange tail with its firefighting markings, and it's escorted by a P-51 in a civilian paint scheme as well. I haven't found the N number of that P-51. I'm dying to figure out which one it was. But
yes, dear viewers, if you know, get in touch with Alex.
Absolutely. So Colonel Joseph Mueller, the last commander of this bomb group in World War II, he's a reserve commander at the Strategic Missile Wing over at Davis-Monthan. They've reactivated the 390th in the 60s, and they've built a small museum over there of the World War II history to give the missileers some history, some esprit de corps. And he's really a driving force in building that museum and helping negotiate for this B-17. So he, Brigadier General Robert Waltz, who had served in the 390th, and Captain Hayes, who's the curator over at Davis-Monthan for the Strategic Missile Wing, have a ceremony when this B-17 lands. It sits over at Davis-Monthan. Some missileers and some EC-130 guys help strip the paint off of it. They apply this paint scheme. They apply this nose art on it. Then they're watching an HBO special, and they see, oh, this plane should have been olive drab. It should have had this white kind of haphazardly done nose art to it. But it's a good representation of a 390th B-17.
Fantastic.
So it sits over at Davis-Monthan for a couple of years, and Colonel Mueller helps negotiate for this building that we're in right now to be built at Pima Air Museum. It's a separate entity. It's a separate 501c3. It's dragged over here. It's still missing its chin turret. It's still missing the ball turret. It's still missing most of the tail. And from the mid-80s onwards, volunteers help restore it back to exactly its World War II configuration.
And I keep saying, when I brought my wife in on Monday, she just went, wow. And it's... you know, interviewing Bill last year, it was, I just wanted to make clear how well this museum is done. And that's even before you get up to the photos, which are just terribly moving in the right way. And I guess we've got to go upstairs and try to find this, the aircraft that this represents in green with her crew.
Well, yeah, and it's stunning. You think about it. This bomb group was assigned about 300 B-17s during the war. Mm. Of the original 35 that left the United States and arrived in England, only one of those original 35 survived the war.
Wow.
Of those 300, none survived the scrapper. Mm. There's not a single B-17 that exists today that served with the 390th. Two have been restored back to 390th square J tail markings. Mm. RB-17 on static display and Liberty Bell, who restoration began in 1992. She flew from 2004 to 2011. Unfortunately, had a catastrophic engine fire, was put down in a field. The field was so muddy, the firefighters couldn't get to it, and that plane was consumed by fire. Oh. And it's under restoration again. But none of the 300 survived. Two were restored back to this bomb group's history.
So, with you as the operations director around here, what's it like coming in the morning? Granted, you come in through the back door, but how often do you sneak in just to have a look?
Oh, and I'm looking for the evidence.
The boss is standing behind us, yes. So don't worry about him.
So my passion project is searching for those pieces of history, yep, of this airframe, but every day is a lesson in perspective. You know, we look at this plane, it's this beautiful plane, and it does represent those 300 aircraft and those hundreds of men, yep, that served this group, and that's just one bomb group out of 40 that was stationed in England waging the air war over Europe. And then you look upstairs and you see 310 crew photos. You see the faces of the young men looking back at you, 19, 21-year-old guys. And that's what this museum is really about. It's not as much about the equipment as it is about the men who flew this, maintained this, armed this. And it's an incredible piece of history. And our days are not dealing with life and death.
No.
These men were really facing life and death every moment of the day. Two-thirds of the air crew did not come home. About one-third became prisoners of war. About one-third were killed in action.
Yeah. And for all the fun and games around movies and TV shows and things, that's the thing that needs to be remembered. And these things were not expected to last, so it's wonderful to be able to get up close and be shown around one with a very, very unique history.
Absolutely.
And now telling fantastic history as well. And Dick's chair as well.
Yes. Yeah. And it's incredible that we have two 100-year-olds World War II veterans that sit here under the wing and they hold court,
yep,
all day long. And it's encouraging to see the young men and women that come in here and they stand there and they listen and then they get to see and touch pieces of history. And it really puts in perspective. The kids today, they're going to be the last generation that gets to meet these World War II histories and hear, yep, the first-person perspectives. So it's so important that we preserve these exhibits, preserve these pieces of material history, so future generations can understand what this war was about.
100%. Alex, thank you so much for your time and for showing us around.
I appreciate it.
Cheers.
We're going to take a quick break to pop to the Pima Air and Space Museum to visit with Director of Collections Andrew Bailey and find out about one of the aircraft in the incredible Pima collection.
Welcome to the Pima Air and Space Museum. Today we're going to talk about one of our most recent restorations, the General Dynamics F-16B Fighting Falcon. The Fighting Falcon was a response to the Air Force looking for a lightweight fighter that was a cheaper alternative to the expensive F-15. It ended up developing from an air superiority fighter into a multi-role aircraft. It was named the Fighting Falcon, but was commonly known as the Viper by its pilots, which came from the popular TV show Battlestar Galactica, which featured the Viper fighter. The B model is a fully combat-capable trainer version of the F-16A. Its only difference between the A model is that it had a shorter range due to less fuel cells because of the second seat. Other than that, it had the same performance and weapons capabilities. Our aircraft was the first F-16B to come off the assembly line. It served in training units at Hill Air Force Base, Luke Air Force Base, and MacDill. It then ended up with the Florida Air National Guard, and then spent the last 3 years serving with the South Carolina Air National Guard before going into storage at Davis-Monthan Air Force Base at their AMARC facility. We ended up acquiring the aircraft in 2017, and after a few years of working on it and repainting it, it went out on display just the last couple weeks.
To find out what's going on at the Pima Air and Space Museum and to see the incredible collection that they have, please visit www.pimaair.org. For more information, and be sure to give them a follow via all the links in the description to this episode.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
And now, back to the show.
We'll be handing this around a bit.
It's a little wood step up.
Okay.
It always gets to me when you're like, how the hell did anyone get out of these things?
It's amazing, isn't it? You think of all the layers of clothing and the gear.
Yes.
The parachute harness, the parachute, the Mae West.
Flak jacket.
Yeah, just, I mean, granted, they were Depression-era kids and shorter and thinner than many of us. But nevertheless, so many of them did get out of these planes in distress. It's just phenomenal.
See, you did promise not to do anything.
So, flare gun in there as well for...
Right, for visual signaling, so... So one way the Germans couldn't listen in on communications between tower and aircraft or among the aircraft in the formation. You can eavesdrop on any kind of radio signal, but not a colored flare.
That absolutely fantastic logo on there, which... Again, not as roomy as you would think.
No, yeah. The crew, including the flight crew, were almost afterthoughts. Bare minimum space, bare minimum survival systems, very little in the way of comfort or even bare bones safety, for that matter.
So as Alex was saying, they were flying the photographic missions at high altitude. So that all that, the oxygen heating systems are all still in the aircraft. Which is there. There we go. Heated suit. Which I guess was always turned up to high.
I can't imagine that it wouldn't be.
But it's, yeah, as someone who spends far too much time with British aircraft, it's always strange not to see the standard six right in the middle of the dash is the slightly different approach that you chaps took over here with instrumentation.
And of course the co-pilot, you know, his job besides spotting relief for the pilot was to really monitor the engine performance gauges. He had the best view of those. Pilot had the aircraft orientation. Basically, the aviator indicators.
You promised, Joe. And, of course, here's autopilot, or handing it over to the bombsite, even.
Yes.
Yep.
Activating the autopilot so that the Norden could fly the plane. And you can see even down that right corner by where his knee would be. The hand pump for priming the engine for startup to get the first engine going.
rudimentary and high tech of its age, all in the same.
Really is, it's we can look at all the analog gauges and the exposed wiring and the bicycle cable, basically, that runs between the controls and the control surfaces. and think, oh, how antiquated. Yet, you know, this was pretty close to the equivalent of space shuttle technology for the 1930s, as the shuttle was to the 1970s. This was high-tech, leading edge, and way and above anything that these young boys would have encountered in civilian life before being thrust into combat in this machine, and having the expectation that you knew its operation down cold, so cold that in the adrenaline rush of combat, during a sudden emergency, a fire, a hit, equipment failure, engine failure, you knew you had muscle memory as to where your hands needed to be going for any particular eventuality. This was extreme high tech for the mid 1930s, and yes, you know, the B-29 came along and had completely different systems.
Pressurization,
incredibly more powerful engines, and navigation, fire control, bomb site, you name it. Very different than the B-17. But nevertheless, this was much akin to like Apollo or space shuttle technology to these kids.
Right. Shall we try not to stand on the sign as we go down?
Again, you know, this never comes across, dear viewer, on the telly. You know,
we're all gentlemen of about 6 foot.
This is not designed for us.
No, it isn't. And this space would have been far more crowded than it is right now, because we don't have the top turret here. We just have a replica. All the machinery that the guy stood in, which is on display over there, is not here.
Yeah, so you're squeezing around that to go back.
Yeah, you had to orient the frame in a certain way in order to go from there to here and back. And again, with all your flight gear on.
That's a good shout, Bill, that we had a lot of space in there that normally wouldn't
be. That's right. It would have been far more claustrophobic for the three of us if it had been fully set up as it would have in combat.
So we've got controls for the turret in there, Norden bombsight out the front, Navigators 50.
Small and large walk-around bottles.
Yeah. H2 exit.
Mm-hmm.
Little view screen. Radio direction finding.
It is absolutely stunning. And interesting that so much stuff was able to stay on board because of the mapping. That I guess you didn't have to go overly mad hunting for, well, the guys that were restoring it going too mad to get all the bits.
It was pretty stripped out for both mapping and firefighting purposes. So a lot of reacquisition of the equipment took place by 390th Veterans when we first got the aircraft on loan from the Air Force.
Oh, I remember you saying that you sort of put the 390th put it, the word for anything anybody had, wasn't it? And
yes,
sort of getting all kinds of bits and pieces.
Ball turret was found under a lady's porch.
Yes.
Drift meter.
Yeah.
I think one of the biggest differences between visitors today and maybe older visitors is understanding the difference in navigation. These guys had to rely very heavily on dead reckoning. They had a few types of compasses and basically best guess as to the true speed above ground, both laterally and forward speed of the aircraft. That's how you guessed your location. There was no look at a screen and this shows you where you are. You used a pencil, a paper map, and you marked where you thought the plane was, and you hoped for enough holes in the clouds that maybe you would see a landmark printed on your map. And if you had no holes in the cloud, then it really became really a wag as to, I think I'm here. I think we're heading this way. I think we'll get home or to the target or both. But there was no machinery, no electronic devices telling you where you actually were.
You had things like this telling you what was below you, but you still had to figure out what the hell this teeny tiny little green screen would have shown you beneath.
And you could turn an antenna located below the nose of the plane here to detect a radio beacon broadcast from England, and it would show us a little spike, like on an oscilloscope, and that could tell you general direction, and you could somewhat interpret on this signal strength as to how far you might be from that antenna if, on that particular day, the Germans weren't actually jamming the frequency that your radio and compass depended on.
Yeah, or spoofing it to try to get you off in the wrong direction, because you had many, many stories of very familiar-sounding ladies and gentlemen telling you, come this way.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for this, Bill. This has been fascinating. And my goodness, has the team done such a wonderful job creating a time capsule, really.
It really is. It's a good description. It's a time capsule for 1945, and when the world was at war. Yeah. And life was very cheap.
Oh, yes. So here we are at the 390th Bomb Group Memorial Museum, and we're chatting to Keith, who has, to be fair, the best job in the building, because he is in charge of all the artifacts, and especially the jackets. So, Keith, let's start with you. What brought you to the museum here? What's your journey into curation?
So I got into this position. It really started off as an internship 5 years ago through the University of Arizona.
And then they'd never let you leave.
Basically, they locked me up. They put the ball and chain on my foot. I've never been allowed to leave since.
Sorry, continue, yes.
So it started off with an internship 5 years ago with the Archives and Collections Department, and then it kind of segued from there. So I went from being the intern to being a member of the team. So I got hired. So I was hired on to a part-time position, and then just worked up the ranks to where I am right now.
So the museum's got such a great story. Last time I was here, I had a long chat with Bill about the history of it, and the fabulous things that the members of the 390th have donated to the museum.
Mm-hmm.
You see all these things coming in. We're clearly going to be talking about the jackets, because those are sort of the eye-catching ones. But what are some of the other things that the museum has in its collection that have been donated?
We've seen quite a few things come through our doors. So we've seen medals, we've seen manuals for B-17s, gunnery manuals, maintenance manuals. We've seen a couple of German artifacts come through here. We've seen patches, we've seen other jackets, not the A2 jackets, but more like uniform jackets. Mm-hmm. We've seen the Eisenhower ones that kind of end at the waist there, the ones that go further down there. We have caps, we've got visor caps. We've got quite a collection here.
It's fantastic. And these artifacts here in the cases, the A2s, first time I saw them, it sort of struck me, because I just walked down the photos. And then you turn around and you see the jackets and you realize that I couldn't fit in one of those, which just reminds me that these chaps were not me.
Oh, yeah. These were pretty young guys, and they were pretty small guys, especially if you were going to be put in the ball turret.
So how many A2s have you got in the collection so far?
So we have a little over 40 jackets in our collection right now.
And are all of them personalized, or is it to some varying degrees?
There are varying degrees of personalization. So the set right now, you're going to see a lot of similar imagery. So you'll see the symbol of the 8th Air Force, like this one right here, a lot of B-17s. Mm-hmm. So there's those very similar images you see that kind of just show how deeply ingrained these things came to be for the airmen that served in the 8th Air Force and with the B-17 in particular. But that doesn't mean there wasn't room for some personalization in there. I mean, we've got people that... There was my favorite jacket in the collection is actually called Uninvited Missionaries, and it literally shows a friar holding a bomb about to throw it. So you got things like that. Small bits of humor. Yeah. Even with the naming of some things, like uninvited missionaries, it's not spelled how you would expect it, right? Because missionaries, it ends with A-R-I-E-S, right?
Yeah.
In this case, it's A-I-R-E-S, so kind of a play on words there.
Yeah. Oh, that's brilliant. Because, you know, the jackets became synonymous, didn't they? And, you know, famously you have the poor guy who put Murder, Inc. on the back of his and then got captured, and mm-hmm. the Germans made a field day of that, but... the little bits of personal touches to sort of show who the kid was who was in this. And I say kid because they would be half my age at that. What about this jacket here, Shuttle Babe? What's the tale behind it?
So Shuttle Babe is actually a reference to a shuttle mission. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't going back to England after its mission. It was flying off to its target, and then it was going to actually land at an airfield in the Soviet Union, mm-hmm. right? So that was what it was called, the shuttle mission.
Yep.
So you go to this Allied airfield up here, refuel, and then you go back. In this case, this person who wore it, his name was Sergeant Calvin E. McCart. He was involved in a supply drop to Warsaw during the Warsaw Uprising of 1944. And so from there, dropped his supplies in Warsaw and then carried on to the Soviet Union.
The drops to the Warsaw Uprising is always one of those things that some people say should have been, you know, hindsight ruling, should have been more drops, should have been less, and mm-hmm. it just ended so terribly. But
well, there was also a lot of politics involved in there. I mean, you had the Western Allies that wanted to support the Polish, and then you had Stalin who was like, I don't want you giving weapons to the people I want to subjugate when I get in.
Let's move on to the next case.
Okay.
What goes into keeping these jackets in such good condition? Because, you know, the colors on them are fantastic, and you know, these are working items that they would have been chucking around and flying in and things like that. How do you preserve these things? That's several. How do you preserve the jackets for, you know, those of us who wander into the museum to see?
So one of the first things we do in terms of preservation is just set up a system of rotation. So what mm-hmm. that means is that we give these guys a rest period between times that we put them out on display. Mm-hmm. These guys will be out on display for like 4 months, and then we'll put them back into storage. And storage is also a critical factor here. So you want to put these lying flat in a box. You don't want them to be like hung up in a coat, like with a coat hanger mm-hmm. inside your closet, because gravity is going to start pulling things down, and it's going to cause some damage long term. You want that storage box to have a nice seal to it because you don't want dust or bugs getting mm-hmm. at that jacket, because some bugs do eat like cloth and leather, like moth damage. You probably know about that. I'm imagining everybody knows about that.
Yes. we know about moths very well in my part of England. Let's not get started on that. Yeah. Lots of carpets are a family of moths.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, so there we go. Sorry, so it's keeping them flat, keeping them dry, keeping them dust-free.
Yeah, flat and dry, especially since you also want a consistent humidity with these guys, because leather is just treated skin, so and it's porous, so it's going to expand and retract in the presence or absence of moisture. Mm-hmm. So if there's that fluctuation, obviously you're going to have that expanding and the retracting going on. And if the leather is getting too dry, that's going to cause some cracking in it.
Mm-hmm. And I guess it'll probably crack right underneath the artwork on the jackets.
Oh, and that's another thing, is if you have that nice consistent humidity, if the paint gets too dry, it's going to start flaking, cracking. And that goes also back to the discussion about the boxes, which is you want it to be lined with, like, you want to give that box some nice padding so that thing doesn't, like, shift around. And ideally, you're going to want to use acid-free tissue paper. Mm-hmm. And I cannot stress enough that you want to use acid-free tissue paper, because regular paper, obviously, has been treated with acids and the wood pulp itself. There are things inside that wood pulp that actually encourage the creation of more acid, so that's why paper turns yellow and brittle over time. Mm-hmm. So, and that acid can be introduced to other artifacts that it's stored with.
Yeah, so that the contact transfer from it will then affect whatever artifact you have in the box.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, if we start heading over here, the Joker one.
Yes.
Which is a terrible way to describe it. It's just the one that sticks into my head.
Oh, no, that's perfectly fine. That's actually the nickname of this squadron was Jokers in the Hole. Mm-hmm.
So, throughout all the collection, do you see similar imagery again and again, because there's so you said the 8th Air Force One, mm-hmm. we sort of see it in variations pop up. Would that because the artist that was painting the jackets would just be, you know, doing the same thing for different guys coming in for whatever they were trading for the paintwork?
It really came down to personal preference. Yeah. I mean, in this case, it wasn't really up for discussion. That was like the unit emblem, yeah. And pretty much all, pretty much most, if not all, these jackets are going to find that unit emblem right there. Mm-hmm. Though there is a little bit of personalization in there. Some of those emblems were embroidered. Others were just painted onto like a piece of leather, like with this guy here, or even just painted directly onto the jacket.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you've got a mix of housing. Like you're saying, you could get a bit of leather, paint it on, sew it on, or as these ones, just straight onto the jacket. Do you know what sort of paints they were using? That's putting you right on the spot. So we can,
I don't have the answer to that. But the people who painted it, it really kind of depended. You could have somebody on the crew who was artistic, or somebody else you knew was artistic, or a local artist in their nearby village. Yeah. With guys on base, it was a matter of, how do you pay these guys? Cigarettes are just favors, things like that.
So the last jacket in the case, you have there for a specific reason, don't you?
Yes. So this one right here, you'll notice, is completely blank. There's no unit emblems, no art on the back. This is the one we call the blank slate. And this one is really kind of meant to be a tribute for the guys that didn't make it home after the war, the guys who were shot down.
Yep. And I think it's really fitting. I really like that in there. Is, of course, let's ask the geeky question. Is it a new jacket, or is it a jacket of the period?
Oh, it's a jacket of the period. Actually, that's the thing. A lot of jackets, the majority of A2 jackets, were not actually decorated. Mm-hmm.
So when we see sort of film and TV shows of everybody having painted jackets or painted things, that wasn't standard.
So that wasn't really like, you weren't going to find everybody with a painted jacket on them. Mm-hmm. You'll find a unit patch, and obviously you'll find an ID tag on them. But by and large, a lot of jackets were not decorated. And even some that were decorated, sometimes the decoration could be really small. Like one jacket in our collection, it's literally just Hellcats, tiny lettering, yellow paint on the back. That's it.
It's just that dash of, I'm an individual. Yeah. In a great big machine.
Yeah, there's a lot of individuality in it. And even with some common symbols you see, like bombs or things like that, that say how many missions you flew, there are different ways in which people organize them. Like the shuttle babe over there had the bombs on the sleeves, while as others have it in the back, and sometimes they'll have it in one row, sometimes they'll have it in several rows.
So you got on this one here, the bag end, you've got straight and curved, so the guy's really filling it all in, so it's...
Yeah, so there's a lot of
personal preference.
Yeah, and actually, if you look at this picture over here on the wall, you can actually see, even with different crews, there were different ways in which they organized their stuff. So with these swastikas over here, which likely meant fighters shot down, this guy has them vertically, and this guy over here has them horizontally. So different ways of organization. So same crew, but but adding their own individuality to it.
Yeah, so... Again, similar styles of artwork, but then you're not going to be... each one's individual, each one's being painted to order, and probably not being given a lot of time to get the artwork on the back of the jacket.
Oh, yeah. I mean, getting these jackets was kind of a status symbol for these guys. I mean, we have a couple of jackets where we see flecks of paint on, like, other areas, and it's, like, directly opposite of stuff, And our theory is this guy was so enthusiastic to put it on, he didn't actually give it enough time to dry.
Oh, fantastic. So these are sort of the prominent ones, the things that don't tend to get out on display but are equally sort of, you find, passionate. What are some of those smaller items?
Let's see. Well, medals do carry a lot of weight to them, if you know what they mean. With the air medal in the 8th Air Force. So just some backstory. During World War II, the awarding of, like, the Distinguished Flying Cross to the Air Force, or the air medal, was kind of it varied between different commands. Mm-hmm. In the 8th Air Force, you got the air medal if you finished 5 bombing missions.
Okay.
Like, you finish 5 bombing missions, you get an air medal. You finish 25, you get the Distinguished Flying Cross. So things like that. It's kind of like a sign that you survived that long, which, as most of your guys are going to know, was a pretty tall task, especially early in the war.
Yeah.
We do have several Purple Hearts, which some of your viewers will know is what was awarded for people who were wounded or killed in action. And we have one from a gentleman who was killed in action on his 13th mission, and he was 21 at the time. Mm. So,
it's the youth, isn't it? That
yeah,
you know, we. It's a terrible thing to say, but you see reenactors today who are gentlemen of my stature and belly, who don't always represent a 21-year-old kid who's first time out of the country, most likely. Yeah, and you end up in East Anglia of all places. Yeah, poor guys. If you've ever been, it's a special part of the world. I have friends from there, so I will be getting text messages saying you shouldn't have said that. But we're going to leave it in. And it's, you know, it's a grand adventure, but at the same time, to a quite terrifying reality.
Yes, yeah. It was definitely a daunting time. We also have some pretty interesting things in our collection, which when I first found them, I was just like, where did this come from? Case in point, there is actually a stick in the collection, just a stick from a tree or something like that. The story behind that is that when this plane came home and he had the ground crew working on it, one of the ground crewmen noticed something inside the engine and pulled out this stick. This plane had actually been flying so low to the ground that it just started ripping things up from like the trees it flew over. And so that's how it got jammed in there.
That's brilliant. And again, just linking back to the story and the reality of what was going on. So when we think of museums, sometimes something that someone would think mundane, a jacket and a medal not being mundane, but the smaller sort of inferior as well, that everyday life, random state, adds to the story of what this museum's trying to do.
Exactly. And a lot of what we try to do with these artifacts is present the story behind them, because that's where the power comes in.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, you look at this stick or you look at this medal, and if you don't have that context, it's not going to mean anything to you. But if you give it that human touch, if you give it that story to it, then you develop that connection between the past and the person looking at this artifact. That's how you grab people.
Fantastic. Keith, thank you so much for letting us drag you away from your desk for a few minutes and bring you up here. It's very kind of you. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
No, my pleasure.
To find out more about the 390th Memorial Museum at the Pima Air and Space Museum, do check out their website at 390th.org and find out about the upcoming 390th Bomb Group Gathering at Grissom Air Museum in July. Details are to come, so be sure to follow the 390th on all their social media pages. The Damcasters is hosted and produced by Matt Bone and is a Boney Abroad podcast production. To learn more about our podcasts and check out our previous episodes, head to www.thedamcasterspod.com.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.